You are listening to the Six Figure Freelancer audio course brought to you by Antco from Fiverr. We interview top professionals who share their exact formulas for success in starting, growing, and maintaining a six-figure freelance career. And I'm your host, Juan Felipe Campos. Okay, freelance masterminds, remember, on every episode of the audio course, there's a giveaway of digital goods or resources from our partners that other people don't have access to. To get your audio course resources, subscribe to the audio course on iTunes and then visit and.co/resources. Again, that's and.co/resources to access your digital goods. Paul Jarvis is a freelance designer, author, and creator. He went from a college dropout to creating a job for himself in the 90s that's been more stable than any corporate career. He's worked with some of the biggest entrepreneurs and companies in the world, like Microsoft, Yahoo, Mercedes-Benz, and Warner Music. He helps thousands of freelancers improve their business with his courses, Creative Class, Chimp Essentials, and his new book, Company of One. Let's hear more from him on this episode of the Six Figure Freelancer audio course. Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, no worries, man. Thanks for having me.
Paul, you certainly know something about growing and maintaining a six-figure career that most of us don't. And on this episode, we're going to be talking about actually maintaining a six-figure career so we don't keep dipping down past that line. It's very, very difficult to stay there. So can you demystify a little bit for us some things that you've done to make sure that you can maintain a income of abundance and not keep dipping down?
Yeah, definitely. I think the main thing, and this applies to pretty much every business ever, I think, is that it's easier to work it's easier to get business from people you've already worked with than new business. So retention is easier and less costly than acquisition. And what I found in my own career is that if a client is willing to hire me once, they're probably willing to, as long as I do a good job, as long as I do everything that I say I'm going to do, when I'm going to do it, charge the thing that I quoted them, then they're going to want to hire me again. I had a few clients that I worked with for 15 years that I did 12, 13 projects for. So always going back, always following up. I used to call it my magic email. So if I hadn't heard from a client in a few months, in the beginning, I used to think, okay, if they're not contacting me, they don't need anything from me. And I was wrong, because when I started to contact them and just say, hey, how's your business going? And is there anything I can help you with? Most of the time they would be like, oh yeah, there was actually something that you could do. So always following up with existing clients, with people that you've worked with that you like and that you did a good job for, I think is huge, because then you don't have to go out, pound the pavement, like look for leads. You've already got a pool of leads already there from existing clients, from past clients.
Yeah, and it's something that actually a lot of freelancers are kind of accidental entrepreneurs, in the sense that they're really great designers or really great coders and maybe not as great at running a business or doing sales. And it can be really challenging for artists or great coders to then put themselves in the sales situation. And this totally addresses that. It's like, fine, you don't like doing sales, you don't have to. Just do great work and then be consistent about following up with them.
Exactly. A spreadsheet. Like literally my quote unquote CRM was a spreadsheet. They just had the client name and when the last time I followed up. And at the beginning of every month, I would just look like, hey, okay, I haven't followed up with this person. 2-sentence email. That's it. How's your business going? Is there anything that I can help with? I would always get work from those emails. And it's just like once a month, maybe 20, 30 minutes. And boom, I've got a full deck for that month from that.
So Paul, the elephant in the room for me with this topic is making sure that when people come back to you with work, that it's work that you actually have a process for and that you can service at scale and not something that is going to be a distraction. Because a lot of time clients are like, oh, you do logos. Surely you can do a website, right? It's like similar. It's kind of creative, digital. I don't know anything about that space. Do you do that? So how do you make sure that when clients actually come back to you with work, that it actually is something that you can service and not something that's going to be a complete distraction and then send you on this like rabbit trail?
For sure. So I think that's really important is, one, to have set processes in place for the work that you do, for every project that you do. And I think a lot of times creatives are like, oh, I don't want to be caged in, man, by process. But I actually think that the opposite is true, where creativity, one, thrives on constraints. And two, if you have a process in place, then all of the administravia is taken care of for you. And all you have to do is focus on the creative work so you can get things done. And then to go back to the other part of the question, I'm always very clear with people exactly the type of work that I do. And so even in the getting started guide that I used to send clients, that was a PDF, it would be like, these are the things that you can hire me to do. These are the related things that you cannot hire me to do because I do not do these things. And the other part of that, so all of the list of I do not do these things was kind of like a lead magnet for my network. So when I was doing web design, I was always very conscious of making friends with people who were writers, because every person who gets a website done probably needs some writing on it. Developers, marketers, SEO people, video people. So I'd always have like a pool of talent where I trusted these people. I could refer work to them. They referred work to me. So even if it was a job that I couldn't do, I could go to the client and be like, hey, I'm not the right person for this job, but I actually know somebody who is. And in that situation, I would just refer work to them because they were referring work to me. But you could take a cut off the top. You could work something out with like the videographer or the writer where it's like, can I take like a 5% or 10% finder's fee if I bring you work? And most people would be like, heck yeah, you can.
Yeah.
Because it's free work, basically. You're getting a trust by proxy referral. If the client trusts you to do the work, then they're going to trust who you recommend.
Yeah. And this is so smart because I think a lot of us are already doing this kind of intuitively. We gravitate to people that are in parallel disciplines in our field, and we're like grabbing coffee, we're hanging out, and we kind of have this like preferred vendors list already of just like friends and people we like. It's just we don't have a process for it. And I love the fact that you actually have essentially two menus. So it is a la carte. It's like, these are the things that I do, these are the things that I don't do, but you do start looking for people that you can fit in that menu, let's say, of things that you don't do so that you can still monetize those relationships and you still become a good kind of broker of opportunities for clients that do message you back saying, I do need a logo, I do need a business card. And you're like, perfect, I've got a guy for you and I'm getting paid for it. So this is kind of a good way to do it. Yeah.
And I think sometimes people get caught up in their own industry, like a lot of designers just hang out. So what you were saying a second ago is really important, to make friends with freelancers in related industries, because a lot of times like designers will just have like designer friends and designer networks and writers and but it makes sense to make friends and to network, not just like go to every design conference, but like make friends with people who your clients also need to hire if they're hiring somebody like you.
Before we continue with this episode, I wanted to quickly tell you a bit about Antco from Fiverr. It's software to run your business with everything from invoicing, payments, time tracking, task management, and even freelance contracts and proposals. Get started by visiting and.co. Now on to the episode. Right. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so let's say someone is putting these things in place. They're like, okay, I have my a la carte menu for things I do, things that I don't do, but that I can monetize, and now I'm able to scale this. Let's dive into the things that you actually do. How do you start building processes around that, make sure that you're not doing too many things at once? Because I noticed this is a problem with six-figure freelancers all over. They start taking on things that are very big budget, like I need a $20,000 website, I need a $30,000 website. If you do enough of those, there you go, that's six figures. But you can't continue to do that because your clients don't need $20,000 websites every year. So how do you make sure that the things that you do have in your cart are adding up to enough six figures and that you're pricing them right for it to actually be a six-figure business model and not just that one good year that you had in 2012 that now you can't replicate again?
Yeah, so I think what you said is so important, that there's kind of two ways to do it, right? Where you have like one or two projects that take you over the six-figure mark, or you have many projects, maybe 12 or 15 projects or 20 projects that take you over the six-figure mark. And a lot of people think it would be easier to just do like, okay, if I just do this one project and I'm set. But then right. If you're doing that and you're working with one client for a year, you're not really building your network. You're not building your portfolio. You're not building contact with other potential leads, right? So when that person goes away, typically people don't need, like if they needed six figures of work from one person year after year after year, they'd hire an employee. That's basically right. What an employee does. So the reason they're hiring an employee is or a freelancer is because they don't need that. They need that work now, but they don't need that work again and again and again, like right after another. So what I always did was I always made sure that no single client of mine was responsible for like a third or more of my income, because then I would be getting into that place where I would just be focusing. And like, I didn't want to be an employee. So why would I be taking on a client who's basically treating me like an employee? So I was always looking for myself, it was about a project a month. So I could do 12 projects in a year, and that would take me well over six figures. And I was all, so that way I was always doing some like sales or business development or connecting. So there was always some part of the month where I was working on expanding my network and expanding the people that I'm in touch with that may need my services, as well as like focusing on the work and doing the work. And then what I ended up doing was just raising my rates instead of increasing. So going from like 12 to 20 projects a year, I just stuck with about 12 projects, but it's like, okay, well, I'm charging $10,000. Now I'm charging 12. Now I'm charging 15. Now I'm charging 20. But I was still doing the same amount of work. So I could keep turning clients over and over again. So I would end up with a pool like we were talking about in the beginning, where by the time I got through the pool, there would be years have passed. And then the first client from that pool would be like, okay, it's been like 3-4 years. I need a website refresh. Then they would go back to the start of the line. And then it was almost like a conveyor belt of a couple dozen clients that I was working with at any given time. And a few would drop off because their businesses wouldn't work out, and a few would come back in. But it really was that conveyor belt that just kept the money coming in and kept the projects coming in.
Okay, so there's a really good lesson in here about essentially a sweet spot of fulfillment that you can get to, because if you have too few clients, then any given client will have more than 30% of your income, which is scary, because if you get fired from that one client, like essentially they control your finances. So, okay, you don't want to be so in that end of the spectrum that you're essentially an employee. But then on the other end of things, you don't want to have too many clients to where now you're essentially delivering bad work, A, or B, you're forced to start hiring people under you. And then at that point, you're not really a freelancer. You're an agency owner, and that has its own set of challenges and opportunities. So what you're suggesting is figuring out where that sweet spot is for you, where you have more than two or three or whatever many clients, but not so many that you're an agency owner. And then if anything, increasing your prices time over time, which totally speaks to the whole point of this episode, which is maintaining a six-figure career and as a freelancer, as opposed to how do you graduate and then become an agency owner. Paul, can you see like maybe any other trend other than the ones that we've talked about that are really important to talk about for people that want to maintain the six-figure mark? Have you spotted any other golden nuggets here?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that I've seen with the people that I've talked to is that in order to maintain it, you need to focus on not just doing the business, but running your business. So you have to treat it like because really it is a business, but you have to treat it like a business. So I know a lot of freelancers, they get so busy with work and current projects that they push off the business development, the leads, the networking and all of that. So then they enter this like feast or famine where it's always like
right.
They're completely swamped and booked with client work currently, or there is just a mad dash to find more work. And what I found really worked to really like level out the money where like I kind of know how much I'm making all the time because I'm always doing some work that I'm getting paid to do, but also some networking, connecting, communicating, talking to people, sending out articles that potential clients could like. So I'm always and dealing with leads. So I'm always doing a little bit, and I kind of always had like one day of administration a week. So I knew that, okay, I'd be working 4 days and then one day would be the working on my business, not just in my business. And that was huge for me.
Perfect. Okay. So this is the question that actually, funny enough, I asked Kaylee on a different episode of the same series, what her breakdown was for working on the business instead of in the business. And your answer is essentially 20%. Like if one out of the 5 days out of the week, I'm assuming you just work Monday through Friday, is dedicated to working on your business, essentially putting yourself on more of a CEO role and working on the processes, working on, I'm assuming you do like accounting and taxes and like all of the boring office stuff on that day.
I get that set up for my accountant and lawyer to do. I don't know. I'm not smart enough to do those things.
Okay. But it's still in that world, let's say, of tasks.
For sure.
what day of the week is it? Do you have any input on that? Is it when you start the week? Is it as you're wrapping up the week?
To be honest, I changed it a bunch of times. I had it as a Wednesday, just as like, I'm going to make it the middle day, just because whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, then what I found really worked the best for me was Monday. Like, I just felt like Monday was the day. And it's such a personal preference, too. It's just like, Monday, I'm getting back into the swing of work. Coming off of a weekend, like my brain is more in kind of butterfly mode where it can kind of like dart all over the place. And so I can do all the admin stuff, which isn't really focused or deep work whatsoever. Whereas like the writing or designing that I was doing required like very focused, mindful work. So if I could kind of ease into my work day with like a bit of administration, putting some numbers in a spreadsheet or doing some emails or calls, sending out that magic email I talked about, that kind of stuff worked out really well for me on Monday. So I kept it as Monday instead of Wednesday.
Cool. I like that. Yeah, it transitions your brain from the weekend into workflow mode instead of expecting it to be able to operate for 6-hour chunks of just creative work.
Yeah.
Okay, there is a difference here, though, between our listeners are all over the place in terms of their career. Some of them are very early on. Some of them are more later stage, and they actually are already hitting that six-figure mark. How would the breakdown be? How should the breakdown be in your recommendation between someone that is getting started and their time split of fulfillment work and admin work, as opposed to someone that is more later stage, like in your level, where you can afford to spend 20% of your time on admin work? Does that make sense? So the question is essentially, if you're early stage, how much time should you be spending? Because probably many people are thinking, I can't afford to lose an entire day of my week to work on admin stuff.
But can you afford not? I think my answer is, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't think you can afford not to work on your business, because working on your business is both the admin work and the biz dev work. So like, if you're not actively looking for clients, like, you may be set for this month, but are you set for next month? But if you're always working slightly ahead of your schedule, like the way that I worked was I was always booked a few months in advance, because I was always doing that business development cycle every week where I was talking to people and being like, well, and it's a good, it's like this weird psychology thing where when you tell a potential client, like, I'm fully booked right now, but I can slot you in a month and a half. And I can only put you in the calendar if, one, you sign my contract, and two, you give me a down payment. Then the person on the other end is thinking, like, this person must be good. This person is fully booked right now. So, like, I would never tell a client that I have space immediately, because that seems like this weird psychological thing. Like, why isn't this person busy right now? So even if it's just like, I'm busy this week, I can, like, if you really need the money, like, I'm busy today, I can start tomorrow. I'm busy this week, I can start next week. I'm busy this month, I can start in 6. Like, it doesn't matter, but do something where there is a little bit of a wait, because then the person is going to start to think, like, maybe I should hire this person. Like, if other people are hiring them and they're busy, maybe I should hire them too.
I love that. I love that. Basically, so, you know, if someone's listening to this and they're like, you don't get it, right now I'm in survival mode. It's like, yeah, if you're acting like you're in survival mode, guess what? You're going to stay in survival mode. And if you want to get into abundance mode, you have to start acting like someone that's in abundance mode. And it's going to show in your tone. It's going to show in your speed of answering emails. It's going to show in how you negotiate deals if you actually are exposed to that many opportunities. And people are perceptive to that, and they will see this person is booked. And essentially, it starts becoming true because you're mimicking the habits of people that have the end result that you're trying to replicate. In this case, it's you, Paul, and someone that's early stage can really, really take a note out of your rule book on doing things better.
Thanks. And that's the thing, too, is that a lot of people are like, oh, well, like the comment that I hear the most when I talk to other people about freelancing is like, well, that's okay. That works for you because you're where you're at. And I'm like, no, I work the same way from the beginning. Like, the reason I am where I'm at is because I've been doing these things. I've had these habits. I've had these systems and processes in place from when I started to now. And that's why things have worked out, as opposed to operating one way and then switching when some magical, like, when confetti rains down from the ceiling and like a success flag of like, I don't know what that means. I don't know how that works. But I think we have to operate in kind of, like you're saying, we have to operate in the same way, because people, it's so funny. Like potential clients can smell desperation.
Right.
Like they just have this weird sense of smell. And I think trying to limit your exposure to being in that situation, whether it's like building up a buffer of like money from the job you do before you go freelance, or trying to like cut your expenses down as much as you can, so the more the money you make goes a lot further. Like whatever you can do to make it so you don't 100% need this client right now is just going to do wonders in terms of like the perception that they have. Because you're right, like people can just be like, oh, this person, like maybe they're really desperate for the work. Like maybe they're not the right fit for this if they can't find work. Whereas if you're like, I totally want to work with you, but we need to like, you need to follow some of my rules first. You need to follow my processes and systems, and you need to wait a little bit, but I'm worth it, I promise you. And then they're like, ooh, there's like a velvet rope now. And like people want to like be waiting in line with the velvet rope.
Okay, freelance masterminds, do not forget to pick up your digital resources from this episode. It's very simple. You just subscribe to the show on iTunes, and then once you've done that, visit and.co/resources. Subscribe on iTunes, and then visit and.co/resources to get your digital goods. See you on the next one. Paul, as you continue to grow and take your business forward into the next level, where's the best place for people to stay in touch with you and learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah, so the thing that I do, because I do a lot of things right now, but the main way to follow along and keep in touch is my newsletter. That's called The Sunday Dispatches, and I've written it. It's an article a week every Sunday. I've written it since November 2012, and that is on pjrvs.com, which is impossible to remember. So if you just Google my name, Google Paul Jarvis, I'm the first couple pages of Google for my name, not for all of Google. That would be cool.
just go to google.com. It'll redirect.
Yes.
It's Paul Jarvis.
My newsletter, The Sunday Dispatches, that's the best way to keep in touch and to follow along.
Amazing. Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing all of this with us.
Cool. Thanks, man.